Morning, ladies and gents. Welcome to Please God, what promises to be an amazing and informative morning of learning Torah, learning medical ethics, and getting a lot of perspective from an expert in the field. Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman is an Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine and Associate Professor of Philosophy and History of Medicine at Yeshiva University's Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where he teaches Jewish medical ethics. Rabbi Dr. Reichman received his smicha from Ritz and writes and lectures wildly in the field of Jewish medical ethics. He is the recipient of a Kornfeld Foundation Fellowship and the Rubinstein Prize in Medical Ethics, and was a member of both the Board of the Halachic Organ Donor Society and the Advisory Board of the Institute for Genetics and Public Policy. His research is devoted to the interface of medical history and Jewish law. On a personal note, I was zocher to hear a number of Rabbi Dr. Reichman's lectures when I was studying for Smicha in Ritz. They were always informative, interesting, controversial, and well attended. It's a big schus to be able to have really, truly one of the experts in this incredibly complex, engaging and interesting field here in Boca Raton. And here at BRS, we welcome Rabbi Dr. Reichman. Looking forward to a wonderful morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Tremendously appreciate it. Thank you so much, Rabbi. Tremendous bliss and honor to be here. I am delighted to join you for our final session of the weekend on the advances in the science and medicine over the last year or two. Just a few things I wanted to mention before we begin. I want to thank Jeff Silkin for bringing an article to my attention. Yesterday, we talked about My Sister's Keeper and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, frozen embryos. What's the halachic status of frozen embryos? So this is from literally yesterday's newspaper, from the Sun Sentinel. Loss of embryos brings heartbreak. Thanks, Jeff, for pointing that out. I don't know if anyone else happened to read that article. So we were literally talking about this exact topic yesterday. And it says here that fertility clinic failures may have cost many a last chance to start families. Many of them had already endured their share of heartache. Some had been trying for years to get pregnant, suffering through multiple miscarriages. Others had undergone cancer treatments that destroyed their fertility. Now hundreds of these women and couples have learned that the eggs and embryos they froze for eventual use in starting or expanding a family may have been destroyed by a storage tank failure March 4th at two fertility clinics in suburban Cleveland and San Francisco. So it's a pretty sad, tragic story, and the halachic issues, some of which we discussed yesterday. I also wanted to acknowledge, I gave thanks and tremendous appreciation to the rabbis in this community. There's one that I neglected to mention. It's Rabbi Josh Flug, to whom I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude for the wonderful work that he does and that he produces, of which I am one of the beneficiaries. So I really wanted to thank him so much. They tell a story of a philosopher, an American philosopher, who traveled abroad to China to an international philosophy conference. It was a major national event. And of course, he didn't speak any Chinese. So he was to deliver the main lecture for the entire conference. So they coordinated to speak to a translator. So they had him speak to the translator, and he said, you know, tell me what to do, how often do I have to stop? So the translator said, I will let you know when it's time to stop. So the professor stands up, he begins to deliver his lecture. After a sentence or two, he looks towards the translator. Translator says, keep going, keep going. After 15 minutes, translator stops him, stands up and says five words in Chinese. 15 minutes later, stands up, says another five words in Chinese. Another 15 minutes, another five words. After the hour, he says five words in Chinese, and everybody files out of the auditorium. The professor goes to the translator in awe. He said, I spent my entire life preparing this lecture, and you were able to concise my complex philosophical words in just a few words in Chinese. What did you do? What's your secret? So he said, after the first 15 minutes, I said, so far, he hasn't said anything new. After the next 15 minutes, I said, he still hasn't said anything new. After the third, I said, it doesn't look like he's going to say anything new. And after the fourth, I said, I was right, he didn't. Now, I hope there are no philosophers in the room here this morning. But suffice it to say that in the field of science and medicine, you can't make that statement. The field of science and medicine is proceeding so rapidly that, in fact, it's possible when you go home today after the lecture, you might read something in the newspaper that we will need to discuss that we haven't yet discussed. That is the world that we live in. That is the world that we are privy to, and it is a tremendous schus for us. But at the same time, we as Torah-observant Jews need to view these new developments through a halachic prism. That's our objective today, is to cover some of the fascinating advances and developments over the last year, few years. Obviously, there are many more than we could discuss here. I'm open for questions and discussion afterwards for issues that we don't even address in our lecture. We're going to start at the beginning of life. We're going to work our way through towards the end of life. We start with the world of genetics, and I draw your attention to a wonderful illustration on the upper left-hand side of your handout, which I discovered about a year or two ago. And it really says it all. There's so much. If I were to give you a pen and paper and ask you to write an essay about this, I suspect you would come up with some interesting observations. I'll share with you some of mine. First of all, it is interesting to note that the human genome is analogous to the Torah in many ways. It's a series of letters. It's a series of letters that requires deciphering. And in fact, in the human genome, if one letter is missing, it can render an entire human being, dead, fatal. And in the Sefer Torah, as actually Rabbi Penner mentioned in one of his drushes over Shabbos, if one single letter in the Sefer Torah is missing, the Sefer Torah is puzzle. The other aspect of this, which is beautiful, is that Torah is a part of our DNA. And conversely, and especially the world of Yeshiva University, when this is a Yeshiva University weekend, DNA or science is really a part of our Torah. And that's really what we want to reflect today as we go through some of these very exciting advances. And in a certain sense, a picture is worth a thousand words. Here, a picture is worth 3 billion base pairs or 5,000 words, which are found in the Sefer Torah. So let's begin with the world of genetics. The last few decades in the world of medical halacha, we've been talking about genetic testing. We've been talking about Tay-Sachs disease. Should we test? Should we not test? Should we divulge? Should we not divulge? The next frontier is beyond that. With the Human Genome Project and the identification of literally the entire human genome, we are moving into the next phase. We've identified many of the diseases. Now our objective is to treat those diseases. So we're moving from genetic testing to genetic therapy. Now we've identified the genetic problems. Can we cure them? And some of the advances just over the last few years have been truly extraordinary. One in particular could literally lead to a paradigm shift in treatment of human diseases. But if you take a look on the top, genetics and gene therapy, the future is now. Scientists attempt gene editing inside a human being. Scientists for the first time have tried editing a gene inside the body in a bold attempt to permanently change a person's DNA to try and cure a disease. The experiment was done Monday in California. This gentleman received billions of copies of a corrective gene and a genetic tool to cut his DNA in a precise spot. And we'll talk more about some related developments in just a few moments. So these are truly new and exciting frontiers, but we have to be a little cautious. So for example, in the next entry, Juno halts cancer trial using gene-altered cells after three deaths. Three patients in a study testing the use of genetically engineered cells as a treatment of cancer have died from swelling of the brain. So what are the halachic issues with genetic therapy? So the truth is, the overarching halachic perspective is that we believe in things that will cure human disease. We believe in the license to heal. There's no question about it. Are there any halachic limitations? Are there any halachic prohibitions in the therapy? One of the main issues is the risk. We have to overcome the risk and see if indeed these therapies are effective therapies or not effective therapies. But there's one interesting border which the secular world has just recently crossed. And the question is if we in the Jewish world have any concern about that. And that's the final entry on this handout. And the technology, which I just want to mention, we're going to only discuss it briefly in the context today, but it's going to merit very extensive and expansive discussion over the coming years. And that's a technology called CRISPR. How many people here, by show of hands, have heard of that technology? So about a third of you have heard of this acronym, CRISPR. Some of you may be familiar with it when you open your refrigerators and you look in the bottom drawer. CRISPR is the game-changing, paradigm-shifting technology to which I referred just a moment ago. CRISPR enables scientists to literally, and I'm not a molecular biologist by any stretch, but the way I understand this is basically according to the picture you see on the bottom left-hand side. What the scientists have basically been able to do is the following. They can literally send in machinery to target certain parts of the genome and literally snip them out of the genome and in some cases replace them with other genes. So if you will, it's really a cut and paste kind of function for the human genome. And interestingly enough, again, and I can't attest to this, but from what I read, it's not such a complicated procedure, and many scientists are able to perform this. By the way, I'm sure there are many of you in the room who are physicians, scientists. Feel free at any stage to correct me or to ask questions or to clarify during the course of the discussion today. So the question is, what are the halachic issues that relate to this technology, and how could this indeed be a game changer? So imagine the scenario. You know, you have a gene for Tay-Sachs, you have a gene for breast cancer. You could literally snip out the bad genes and potentially insert corrective genes. Is that something that we would consider appropriate or not appropriate? What does halacha say about such a thing? So the answer is clearly halacha would welcome any such new technology. Again, the risks are concerning. How accurate is this technology, is the cutting technology? And you see a reproductive specialist is shaking his head, no, it's not so accurate. It has its problems.
And because it does, only a certain percentage of these precise cuts are exactly where you want them to be.
So that
a whole bunch of them will not be, and therefore might lead to number two.
Right, exactly. So the potential is truly exciting, but I think we're going to have to see in the future whether the technology is going to be going to achieve the accuracy which is acceptable for clinical application. That's one of the main issues. But if it indeed does, there's no question the postgame would welcome this. But the frontier, even yes. Right, correct. Very good. So I'm very glad that we have experts here in the field to help clarify. So the comment was that not only the cutting, but actually the delivery system, and also when you deliver it to certain parts of the body, you don't know where else in the body the system is going to be cutting. It could cut in areas, more sensitive areas, like neurons, brain tissue, etc. Could affect the reproductive system also, a whole host of things which remain to be seen. So the potential is really extraordinary. Whether that potential will come to fruition remains to be seen. But the border which has been traversed, which in my lifetime, scientists always said they would never traverse this border, is performing genetic experimentation or genetic therapy on the human embryo. So there have always been, for the last few years, discussions and ethics committees about genetic therapy on an individual to the somatic cells, meaning to an individual himself or herself, to correct a disease in that particular individual. They're missing a particular enzyme. We can insert the gene which would produce that enzyme, thereby correct whatever genetic disease that person might have. And that was one of the cases that you saw on the top of our handout today. Never was it considered that a scientist would actually do such an experiment on the human embryo. Why not? Because, as you both mentioned, if you make an error in one individual, the consequences relate to that one individual. If you make an error in the human embryo, it affects all the progeny from that human embryo in perpetuity. However, there are many advantages to working with the human embryo. If you work with an individual, as we saw on the top of this handout, in order to correct the problem, you have to inject billions and billions of cells. If you work with a human embryo, all you have to correct is literally a handful of cells. And if you correct those handful of cells at the early stage, all the cells that develop from those cells will have the correction. So it's a twin-edged discussion, a double-sided discussion. So until now, scientists haven't been doing this, but over the last year or two, and at the bottom, this is just one example of a handful of examples over the last 2 years, Chinese scientists fix genetic disorder in cloned embryos, a method of precisely editing genes in human embryos hints at a cure for blood disease. Now here also, so it, does halacha differentiate between using the embryo and not using the embryo? Not in any specific fashion. If the correction could be corrected and it becomes effective, I don't think there would be any fundamental distinction between experimentation or therapy on the embryo versus the non-embryo from a halachic perspective. And we talked yesterday about what the status of the human embryo is in the laboratory. Is it considered a life or is it not considered a life? And we said that it's not considered a full human life in the laboratory. Now let's turn the page. Another technology which hasn't yet come to fruition, and I know I discussed with one of you yesterday, is the technology of cloning. And in the halachic literature about 20 years ago already, many of the poskim, many of the rabbis, when Dali was first cloned, talked about the approach to cloning. Should we in fact clone? Should we not in fact clone? is it considered an intervention into the world which we shouldn't do? And that's really been discussed extensively, but it hasn't really been an issue because cloning hasn't become a reality. Why hasn't human cloning become a reality? Scientists in the room, why hasn't human cloning become a reality? Anybody know? Why haven't we been able to cross that border? Now, in theory, we should have been able to cross that border, and in fact, we've cloned monkeys just about a month ago. I don't have it in your handout, but just about a month ago, scientists have advanced from sheep to monkeys. They've cloned horses. They've cloned pigs. We'll talk about it in a moment. So, I mean, I'm not sure the answer to that. I mean, it could very well be. I mean, I theorize, and obviously we'll know the answer to this in due time, that perhaps the Kadosh Baruch Hu created an impediment to the possibility of human cloning, and maybe nature only will allow for animal cloning and not human cloning. Yes? So you're resting on the assumptions that physicians will stop based on the fact that they've had adverse results. And that may be true for Western ethically trained physicians, but in the world at large, where many scientists are not governed by the ethics, it is quite possible that they would just continue the experimentation until they succeeded. Thanks. So who knows? Maybe in our lifetime we'll see a cloned human being. And to be honest, there could be a cloned human being walking the face of the earth that we simply don't even know about yet. That's also a possibility. But cloning has been advancing. And you see here cloned... Now, some of you may remember when Dolly was cloned, there was a concern that she aged prematurely. That was one of the concerns about cloning. So, for example, you clone someone who's 65 years old, and you take their DNA and you produce a clone, that new embryo, at what chronological age does that embryo start? Does it start at 65? Does it start at zero? Does it start somewhere in between? So the assumption was with Dolly, after a very short period of time, Dolly developed severe arthritis, other signs of severe aging. So the assumption was that the aging process would continue where it left off as opposed to restarting the clock with the cloning process. But the research here from about a year or two ago shows that Dolly's, literally the sheep that were cloned simultaneous with Dolly, have been living for many years in a very healthy way without premature aging. So again, we don't know what the future is going to hold on this, but only time will tell. They've been cloning horses. Now they're cloning monkeys as well. But let us turn to towards the end of this page and some really extraordinary advances in the world of genetics, specifically focused on organ transplantation. Yesterday we talked a little bit about the donation of blood, bone marrow, kidneys, etc., and some of the halachic ramifications. Imagine this scenario, and this is not science fiction. This is actually proceeding as we speak. Scientists are looking for ways, anyway, to increase the pool of organs. There are 150,000 people in this country awaiting organs. And if you go on UNOS, UNOS, United Network of Organ Sharing, .org, there's a list of exactly the number of people in this entire country that are awaiting organs. And if you look at that list, it's updated multiple times a day. List goes up, list goes down. And it goes down for two reasons. It goes down because someone gets an organ, and it goes down because someone unfortunately doesn't get an organ and doesn't survive to receive an organ. So scientists are looking for every imaginable way to increase the pool of organs, including, by the way, receiving compensation, selling organs, which is another halachic issue, which we're not going to discuss today, but the short answer is the overwhelming majority of rabbinic authorities do not find any problem with receiving compensation for organs. But it is, if it's illegal, it could be an issue of dina de malchus of dina. But here's another fascinating frontier. And here's the scenario, and again, not science fiction. They're taking animals, such as a pig or a sheep, in their early embryological stage, removing the cells that would produce a specific organ, say a liver, and replacing them with the human early developmental cells instead. So what you have, in a sense, is a sheep growing with a human liver. The liver is entirely human cells. Again, this is not science fiction. This is happening. Therefore, if you wanted a liver, you don't need to wait for, God forbid, somebody to die or just someone to donate a living donor. You call the farm and you say, I need a liver. And they'll send you the liver. So the halachic questions are as follows. If you shecht this sheep, what's the status of the liver? Can you eat the liver? What if this sheep has a human liver, a human heart, human kidneys, and it's 51% human cells, and it's grazing in the fields? What's the halachic status of the sheep? Is it a sheep, or is it a human being? So if you look at this fascinating Yerushalmi on the bottom of this handout, reading in the second line, it's actually quoting the Yerushalmi. Behavius divya Yerushalmi, how do you determine the status of an animal versus a human being? So Yerushalmi says, shahakol toli b'tzuras hapanim. Everything depends on the facial features. She'im kulo adam upanov kibehema. If it's entirely a human on two legs and two arms, but its face is the face of an animal, afilu kore batora, even if that creature is standing at the bima and reading the Torah, omrim bo v'nishchot oscha, we say, come and let us shecht you. Hope there's no Bali Kriya here. I apologize for the... V'im hayu panav ka'adam v'kulo k'behema, and the converse, if its face was the face of a human being, but it was grazing the fields like a sheep or a cow, b'choresh basadeh, plowing, omrim lo bo v'chalotz leishas achicha. You say, come and perform the levirate ceremony, i.e., you have the full status of a human being and a halachic Jew. Now, obviously, I'm not saying we apply this principle directly to the 21st century, but it is fascinating nonetheless that the Yerushalmi was at least thinking about interspecies mixing. And we today in the 21st century have to give that very serious thought. And we talked yesterday just briefly, for example, of gestating a human embryo in an animal, in a cow, for example, and a cow giving birth, if you will, to a human embryo. How does that affect the status of the child? So we had a discussion a little bit about the surrogate motherhood. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a few moments. There are different approaches today in a scenario where one woman provides the genetic material and one woman provides the womb. Who's considered the halachic mother in such a scenario? Very important to know. So, for example, to whom do you send a card on Mother's Day? You send to the genetic mother? Do you send to the birth mother? Hallmark paskins that both mothers are considered the halachic mother. What if one mother is a Jew, one mother is not a Jew? Does the child need a conversion? But what if the birth mother is an animal? What is the status? If you hold that the birth mother is the halachic mother and an animal is literally gestating the fetus, what's the halachic status? Is it possible to say that your mother-in-law is a cow? I'm not sure. These are things that you have to consider. Yes?
I'm missing something. I transplant a cow's liver into you, it's going to reject 100%. Why is it that a human liver and a cow doesn't reject?
Why are these cells not rejecting? I think partially because they're doing it at the early embryological stage before the immunological system develops. So if you get it that early, I think there's no rejection. But it's a good question. I don't know the real answer to that. That's my assumed answer. But again, I'm not an immunologist or a biologist that would know. It's an excellent question. Yes?
Is there an issue of chelation in this?
Ah, good question. I mean, this is real chelation. You're really mixing. So according to the Ramban, who expands the concept of chelation to include things that aren't specifically addressed in the Torah, he may actually consider this a case of kilayim, but others who don't apply his more restrictive approach, it would not necessarily be kilayim. Yes?
So the next four words in the Yerushalmi say, Mar Yasin Benola Meisha. So does that relate to this?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. Right. It would. It would. And we'd have to have a discussion about whether it's Nolad Meisha or not. The Gemara Nida has other interesting animal-human discussions, and it talks about a case of a woman who gives birth to a child that looks like an animal, has the features, the morphological features of an animal. Does that woman have to observe the ritual tomb of Atara as if she had given birth to a human child? And they have the exact kinds of discussions. What is it that determines? And there's extensive, complex halachic sugyas about if the creature evolves from a kosher creature, is it kosher? If it evolves from a treif creature, is it treif? A yotzi mina tame, a yotzi mina aser. And these are fascinating discussions beyond the scope of this discussion today. But let me share with you. Yes. We're going to get to that. Hold on to that thought. Okay. Now, let's look at the next technology on the bottom of this page. Gene editing spurs hope for transplanting pig organs into humans. And we talked about CRISPR, and somebody mentioned here the viruses of CRISPR also. One of the other frontiers that scientists are experimenting with is called xenotransplantation, transplanting from an animal into a human being, just taking a pig heart and transplanting it into the human being. And in fact, there's been a case already of baboon transplantation to a human being. And interestingly, perhaps ironically for the Jewish community, the animal which is most fitting physiologically, anatomically, is actually the pig for transplantation. And in fact, many of you are probably aware that we've already been utilizing the pig in medicine for a number of decades for valves. We used to have porcine valves from a pig, valves from a cow, bovine valves. Insulin used to be derivative from pigs, porcine insulin. Are these halachic issues? So the halachic issue of these really is, it's not a halachic issue. These really, the prohibition of these issues is really ingesting, oral ingestion. So porcine insulin, bovine valves, even pig transplants from a halachic perspective really doesn't provide any major halachic impediment. So what they're doing here is the following. They're taking, why hasn't pig transplant been successful until now? The reason is pigs have certain viruses intermixed into their DNA. Those viruses, called zoonoses, are potentially harmful and fatal to the human being, and scientists haven't quite been able to figure out how to address those, how to get rid of them. So what they've done is the following. They've used the CRISPR technology that we mentioned before to literally edit out the viruses from the genes of the pig. When they've edited, and this has been done, again, this is not science fiction, they edited out the viruses of an embryo, cloned the embryo, and produced pigs that are completely virus-free. So those pigs, in theory, and we'll probably see it over the next few years, how successful this is, they will be able to harvest the hearts from these pigs to use for transplant for human beings. That's that would be the next frontier. Now let's turn to the next page. Infertility and reproduction. There have been tremendous advances in the world of fertility and reproduction. So the late 20th, early 21st century, we were talking about in vitro fertilization, assisted reproduction, artificial insemination. Things have been progressing significantly. For example, cryopreservation has advanced significantly. And the ability to freeze things has advanced significantly. So human sperm has been frozen for many decades. The next part of the human reproductive seed, or in assisted reproduction, the next substance which was frozen was the human embryo, was able to be frozen. It took a while to be able to freeze the human embryo. The last frontier of the human reproductive cells that has been able to be frozen is the human egg cell. The egg cell has not been able to be frozen for many decades. Why not? Why hasn't the egg been able to be frozen alone, just the egg? Because the egg is comprised of water significantly. There's water, a high percentage of the egg cell is water. And just from a technical perspective, when you freeze something which has a high percentage of water, it creates icicles, it ruptures the membrane when you either freeze or defrost it. So the ability to freeze the human egg is something which has just been, a hurdle which has just been overcome in the last decade or so. It originally was done in mind with people who suffer from cancers. So someone suffers from a cancer and they need to undergo certain therapies. The objective was, the concern was that the therapies will render the people infertile. So what would they do? They would preserve the reproductive seed beforehand. Now they've been preserving the male reproductive seed prior to chemotherapy for many decades, but they haven't been able to preserve just the egg prior to chemotherapy. Now they can preserve just the human egg. And so, for example, if you see the picture on your handout in the middle left-hand side, anybody know who that is? That's actually Angelina Jolie. That's the firmest picture of her that I could find. She actually looks like a Chabad shlucha. What do you guys think? And she actually is one of the people, she's really more of the breast cancer gene issue. She raised a lot of these issues. But the egg freezing issue has come to our community in a very interesting way, which some of you may be aware of, some of you may not be aware of. So freezing the egg for these kinds of issues for chemotherapy was the original frontier, but now they are offering egg freezing to everybody. And in fact, Google and Apple and the Pentagon offer to finance egg freezing for all their women employees. Now why is that? The reason is they want to keep them in the workforce longer. So all these women, instead of becoming pregnant, will freeze their eggs, develop or advance their careers, and then at a later stage, use those eggs for fertility purposes. In the Jewish world, egg freezing has an extremely important role. I don't know how many of you read articles every week in the press on the Shidduch crisis. So we have a serious Shidduch crisis. And there are many women who haven't yet met their Shidduch. The question is this option an interesting option for women who at a certain biological age haven't yet found their shidduch? Should we encourage, or is it halachically permissible for a woman, a single woman, to freeze an egg, say at the age of 30, 32, or 28, and then have that egg, if, you know, Mirtz Hashem, she'll meet her shidduch and be able to conceive naturally, but maybe she won't meet her shidduch till she's 40 years old, or even 45 years old, and would be able to have a biological child even after menopause, in theory, could have her own biological child, and she could serve as a gestational carrier for her own genetic egg and her husband's reproductive seed. The oldest age that a woman has been able to carry a child, I mean, we know from the Torah, we know an old age where women have carried a child, but the oldest age, I think, is 70 years old in the modern era. There may be a case a little older. A case in Israel, I know, is 67, 68. There's a case in India of a woman who is 70 years old. It was not her egg. It may have been her husband's reproductive seed, may have been her husband's sperm, but it is physiologically possible for a woman, even postmenopausal, to carry a child. But some of the interesting frontiers over the last couple years, the first case of a child born from eggs frozen before puberty was recorded in 2016. So eggs frozen after puberty have been physiologically possible to use those for reproduction. But what about harvesting before puberty? Maybe they wouldn't be viable. Maybe they wouldn't be usable. Now, these cases, the harvesting before puberty, are usually in cases of cancer. Those are cases where you're going to treat a child who tragically suffers from a particular cancer. You want to preserve their fertility. Fertility preservation is a major part of oncology, a major part of treatment of cancers. In the male, there's also an analogous issue in the male. Fertility preservation in the male, in an adult male, has been relatively easy. You just harvest the sperm and you freeze it. But what about fertility preservation in a child before puberty, in a male before puberty? There's no viable sperm. How are you going to freeze the sperm so that the child will retain ability to have children? Yes. Right, so good question. What's the halachic issue? So one of the halachic issues is that you require a hormonal manipulation and a surgical procedure. So it's not a major impediment, but it is an issue to discuss. And let me just close that loop for a second. The bottom line is many contemporary rabbinic authorities, including Rav Asher Weiss and Rabbi Willig, support egg freezing. It is really only mildly problematic from a halachic perspective, and clearly the benefits outweigh the risks. There are interesting discussions, by the way, for a single male to procure reproductive seed in fertility preservation. Let's say you have someone who's 18 years old and tragically is diagnosed with cancer, and you want to preserve the reproductive seed. Is it halachically permissible for a single man to emit reproductive seed for the purposes of ultimate reproduction, should he get married and, God willing, survive? So the rabbis debate whether it's permissible in such a stage. Perhaps only a married man is allowed to procure the sperm, and there is indeed a halachic discussion about this. But going back to the early stages of developments, let's say of a child who's 10 years old. So now scientists are doing the following. They are harvesting what's called spermatogonial stem cells, which is a fancy term for early developmental cells in the testicular tissue, even before a child hits puberty. And they can preserve those and culture and cultivate those at a later stage. So God willing, the child survives cancer, they will have viable reproductive seed to have their own genetic children at a later stage. So these are things which need to be discussed halakhically also, because a testicular biopsy to procure the tissue, technically, from a technical perspective, any trauma or violation of the integrity of the reproductive organs could render an individual a serus. Serus is a halachic term which has profound halachic ramifications. Somebody who is a serus is not able to marry into Klal Yisrael. Most people don't know this, sort of an unknown halacha. So rendering someone a serus is a very serious concern. Can you just put a simple needle to extract testicular tissue? So the bottom line is, many poskim, including Rav Moshe Feinstein, said that it's not an issue, especially since your objective is not to render them infertile, but your objective is to preserve fertility. Yes, you had a question.
By preserving genetic material from the person who has cancer at a young age,
Good question. Not necessarily. Not all cancers are genetically inherited. Also, not every sperm is going to have that genetic problem. Some cancers are just spontaneous mutations. Also, if indeed they did have a particular gene for cancer, you could perform pre-implantation genetic diagnosis when you use that sperm and to isolate, if it's possible to isolate that particular genetic condition, to preclude the propagation of that to subsequent progeny. So that is an excellent question. 3D printed ovaries help mice get pregnant. How many people here have a 3D printer? Anybody? So we got one person with 3D printer. Does the Shul own a 3D printer? I can't believe Boca Raton Synagogue does not own a 3D printer. 3D printing is all the rage. Prices of 3D printers have come down significantly. You know, many kids now have on their Hanukkah wish list 3D printers. 3D printers in the medical community have made tremendous advances. I don't know how many of you here are surgeons. 3D printing has entered the medical world in a number of different ways. One way is the following. You have complex surgical anatomy. So, for example, I work at Montefiore. Montefiore is famous for separating conjoined twins. We actually discussed very briefly Shabbos morning the craniopagus twins that are conjoined by the head. And there's a surgeon in Montefiore who separated about 12 cases of conjoined twins at the head. It used to be they would do a CAT scan, and then they'd go into the OR. Based on the CAT scan, they'd try and figure out the anatomy, and sometimes it didn't exactly correlate the way they understood. Today, they do an MRI, and they convert that MRI into a 3D printed model. And the surgeons literally practice on these models multiple times. They just keep creating models for them, and they just keep practicing on the models until they're comfortable enough with the procedure. So when they go in, they know exactly what they're going to be encountering. The other place where 3D printing has been introduced is there is a recommendation that all soldiers that go to the battlefront should get a full body MRI, so that they have imaging of different parts of the body should they lose those parts of the body. For example, a bone, it could be reprinted in a 3D printer to replace into the body. Very fascinating, fascinating thing. So here you have an example in the world of fertility, 3D printed ovaries to help get mice get pregnant. And in fact, there is a great TED Talk, for those of you who watch TED Talks, of a scientist 3D printing a kidney. And the printing is actually taking place behind him as he's speaking. And now it's not a completely functional kidney, but they're interesting halachic ramifications from this perspective. What is the halachic status of a 3D printed organ? Does it require kvura? Does it require burial? Does it have tuma, batara? If a kohen touches an organ which is printed in a 3D printed fashion, is the kohen metame? These are questions which we need to be addressing. On the bottom here, I don't know if you picked up this fascinating case of superfetation. What is superfetation? California surrogate mother unknowingly gives birth to biological son. This is really a remarkable case, the only case of its kind that I'm familiar with. Surrogate in California here, my wife is in California, actually, that's why I said that. Gave birth to twin boys for a Chinese couple in December, later learned from a DNA test that one of the twins was her biological child. So how did this happen? This happened in the following way. She was a surrogate for this family. They implanted embryos there. And it so happened that she was able to achieve pregnancy from her husband in the natural fashion at the same time. So she actually gave birth to two children. I'm sorry?
Do not follow the rules and
regs. Right. Actually, I'm curious, actually. There's many things which are unanswered there. She's not allowed to have relations for months before, right? You know, in the infertility field. She is obviously not prohibited, but they are told not to have relations before. But also, they usually do pregnancy testing the day of the implantation to make sure the woman isn't actually pregnant at the time of implantation. So it must have been that she was very early. Or it's also possible she had relations afterwards. and from an ovulation was able to conceive. So this actually is called superfetation. Actually, I'm not going to get into the technical terms, but there's actually two words which are slightly different and reflect two different medical realities. One is called superfecundation, and the other is called superfetation. Superfecundation is the following, and by the way, this has been known. So she basically had two children that were genetically completely unrelated to each other. One was hers, and one was the Chinese families. This has been known already since the Middle Ages, perhaps even since antiquity. It is possible for a woman to ovulate more than one egg and to have two children that are genetically unrelated to each other. She has relations with two different men in a relatively short period of time. So that they knew this in antiquity when a woman gave birth to twins and one was white and one was dark. They didn't understand the science behind it. We now understand the science behind it. But there is a concept called superfetation, which is the following, which isn't exactly this case, which the Gemara actually talks about. The Gemara asks if a woman can be misaberes v'chozeres u'misaberes. So if you read this, what does that mean, misaberes v'chozeres u'misaberes? To get pregnant and then get pregnant again. So the Gemara is talking about is superfetation possible, which means, is it possible for a woman to become pregnant with one ovulation and then 2-3 months later get pregnant again? Do we think that's possible scientifically? So most people say that's not possible scientifically, and in fact, I don't even think we honestly know if it is or is not possible, because we don't always know, we don't always assess. And the only way to find out is you literally do an ultrasound of a pregnancy every single day, and you even that wouldn't necessarily determine it. But there's a lot of unanswered questions, so Gemara Bavli does not accept the possibility that a woman can be chazeres, umisaberes. And science today doesn't necessarily accept it either. So let's turn the page. Women, now, yesterday we talked about organ transplantation. Organ transplantation is preceded generally over the last couple decades with vital organ transplants. Vital organ transplants are transplants for organs like livers, kidneys, hearts. Now, the scientists are expanding it to what are called non-vital organ transplants. Non-vital organ transplants include the hand, the ovary, the uterus, which we're going to talk about in a moment, the larynx. I mentioned earlier, if you transplant the larynx is the voice box. If you transplant the larynx of a woman into a man, is that considered kol isha or not? Just this year, there's been a case of uterus transplant here in the United States with a successful birth. And yesterday in our Pidyon HaBen class in the morning, we asked the following question. We said, if a woman was born without a womb and she receives a transplant of a uterus from another woman, and that woman had multiple children, including a firstborn male child, now you transplant it into the recipient and she is pregnant with a male child, does that child require Pidyon HaBen or not? Is it the uterus which determines the status, or is it the individual, the human being, that determines the status? And what was the answer to the question? Yeah. Answer is, she's probably going to get a cesarean section anyway, so there's no Pidyon HaBen required. There's the answer to the question. And if uterus transplantation is possible, then is the following not possible? Men could get pregnant tomorrow. Fertility professor claims. Men could get pregnant as soon as tomorrow thanks to developments in womb transplantation. So if you can transplant the uterus into a woman, why couldn't you transplant that physical organ into a man and then conceive a child in that womb? It'd be great, right? It'd be great. So the men could conceive the child. So what would further be great? So obviously a woman would not want to have the pregnancy. It'd be nice if the man could have the pregnancy. But the new technology is even more fascinating, and the complications here are really quite extraordinary. Scientists create artificial womb that could help prematurely born babies. By the way, the cartoon... I forgot to mention the cartoon in the upper right-hand side, you know, apropos your comment. So the uterus transplant was a success. I'm sure you'll find your husband much more understanding now. But this technology, which came out of CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, is the following. According to this technology, you could take they took a goat out of the womb of its mother at a very early developmental age and placed it into an artificial amniotic sac, which you can see on the right-hand side over here, which looks basically like your standard Ziploc bag. I don't know if any of you do sous vide. Anybody does? This kind of looks like... looks like sous vide. But this is literally an amniotic sac that's made out of a plastic bag, specially designed fluid. They connect the umbilical cord to these cords, etc. The ultimate objective of this research, and many scientists across the globe, is to perform what's called ectogenesis. Ectogenesis means development of the child outside the womb, completely from beginning of life, from conception until... You notice I'm pausing here, because it's not birth. There is no birth. There's plucking, there's decanting, there's extraction. There is no birth. So I challenge you, I mean, I wrote them down. If you read them, don't, you can cheat, it's okay. But what do you think are the halachic ramifications of such a technology? Any thoughts about what the halachic ramifications are of gestating a fetus entirely ex utero? When would his bar mitzvah be? Right, there's no birth. There's no birth. So let's start from the most basic question. You have a fetus inside an artificial womb. Is it even human? Now, we always say man of woman born. How many of you are familiar with the Shakespearean play, you know, with Macbeth about no man of woman born will cause you harm?
What would be the Tsar Tel Dibanim?
Tsar Gidol Banim. Well, Tsar Gidol Banim.
The Tsar goes away also if they...
Well, the Gidol Banim is the raising the children. Believe me, you got plenty of trouble. You still got plenty of trouble there. You don't have to worry about that. But just a few things to contemplate. First of all, is such a child even considered legally human? Two, those who maintain that maternity is defined by gestation. If you gestate in a plastic bag, would the plastic bag then be your mother? These are things to think about. Pidyon HaBen, can you violate Shabbos to save the life of a fetus in a plastic bag? We talked about yesterday. To save a ovary in a laboratory, what about a fetus in a plastic bag? And other things to consider. Let's turn to the next. Right. That actually is a fascinating question. So the assumption is that the artificial womb, in theory, should proceed the same way, should proceed 9 months, but could they manipulate the nutrients, could they manipulate things in such a way that a child would grow faster or slower? You could decide on a birthday. You know, if you want to have a birthday that you like, you know, you want to have a birthday on Yom HaTzmaut, you want to have a birthday on another family member's birthday, you could decide whatever birthday you want. You could also have many children at the same time. Multi-gestational pregnancies, which has its own potential halachic ramifications. You could have 5-6 children gestating in multiple embryos. How do you define the bechor? How do you define the firstborn? You know? You got all these different embryos gestating. I mean, we could write a nice novel about this. Yes?
I'm just out of curiosity. Are any sources discuss the halachic status of Adam
Rishon? Oh, good question. So, right, because Adam Rishon was not of woman born. So that's exactly the point. And some argue, if you say, and this actually relates to a question that was asked to the Chacham Tzvi. The Chacham Tzvi was asked a question going back to the 1600s. If a golem, you guys know what a golem is, right? Everybody know what a golem is? Artificially created creature. If a golem comes into shul, and the golem is your 10th man, does the golem count for a minion or not? Famous tshuva of the Chacham Tzvi. So basically, is a golem considered a human being? Is an artificially created? So in that circumstance, the golem was created with the Kabbalistic sources. Is such a human being considered, such a being considered human or not? So he said, he contemplated that if indeed, maybe, it says, Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam, damo isha feich, which is the source of the prohibition for abortion for a non-Jew, one who sheds the blood of a man within a man, a being within a being, it's prohibited. So who is considered a adam ba'adam? Who's a man? How can you have a man within a man? So it refers to a fetus within a woman's womb, a creature within a being within a being. So he contemplates the idea that perhaps the definition of a human being is a man of a woman born. It has to be a child that was born through gestation of a woman. So then the question was asked, what about Adamarishan? That can't be the definition, because then Adamarishan wouldn't have been a human being. So yes, indeed, people discuss that exact issue. I want to share with you, and I think this will be our... maybe we'll spend another 5 or 10 minutes if that's okay. This will be our penultimate issue, will be the issue of mitochondrial DNA. And I want to share with you two fascinating developments in the halachic world, which if I were to say, you know, what this year has been, I would label this the year of the mitochondria. And I'll explain presently. We talked about halachic issues related to definition of maternity. And there's some poskim that hold that maternity is defined by gestation, those who give birth to a child. And there are those poskim who hold that maternity is defined by genetics, the mother who's genetically related. Now, there's new technology that's going to challenge those who hold that it's genetics, which is the halachic determinant. And this is the technology. How many of you are familiar with the Charlie Gard case? Anybody hear of the case of Charlie Gard? That was a child who was severely ill in England, and they wanted to bring him to the United States for experimental therapy, and Trump offered to support it. At the end of the day, unfortunately, the child did not survive. So the child had a very severe fatal illness. The disease that he suffered was a mitochondrial disease. It was a disease which is found in the mitochondrial DNA. We have DNA in our bodies in two places. We have DNA in the nucleus, and we have DNA in the mitochondria. The DNA in the nucleus is 99.99% of our DNA. In this small structure called the mitochondria, floating in the liquid of the cell, is 0.001% of our DNA. Sometimes the DNA in the mitochondria can be defective. When it's defective, it can cause heart disease, neurological disease, fatal disease. Sometimes it can cause death. What is possible today? Again, this is not science fiction. It is possible now to do the following. You have a woman who has defective mitochondrial DNA. You can take her egg, remove her nucleus. Take another egg of woman B, remove the nucleus of woman B. Then take the nucleus of woman A and implant it into the egg. I'm sorry, the nucleus of woman A, implant it into the nucleus of woman B, which has normal mitochondria. So now you have a composite egg of the nucleus of woman A, the mitochondria of woman B. You can then fertilize that egg with woman A's husband's seed and produce a child. That child has three genetic parents: the husband, the nuclear DNA donor, and the mitochondrial DNA donor. If you hold that the determinant of maternity is genetics, which genetic contributor is the halachic mother? Is it the nuclear mother, or is it the mitochondrial mother? And we can envision a scenario, as I said on Shabbos morning, of a child turning to his mother saying, "You can't talk to me like that. You're only my mitochondrial mother." What's the halacha say? So the poskim have been discussing this with Asher Weiss. So if you had to choose a halachic principle that you could apply when you have a scenario where you have a tremendous amount of one thing and a very small amount of another thing, Rove. So Asher Weiss says maybe we should apply the principle of Rove. And that's what he says. Rabbi Bleich is not in agreement. He says that you would not apply the principle of Rove. Rove doesn't apply to determining status. Yes? The answer to that, I believe, would probably be yes, but I'm not sure. But here's the question that he asks. Let's say, yesterday we talked about Pidyon HaBen. Pidyon HaBen, if you're a Kohen or a Levi, the mother is a member of the Kohen or Levi tribe, also doesn't get a Pidyon HaBen. Let's say a woman is an Israelite and receives a mitochondrial donation from a Kohen or a Levi. Do you get a Pidyon HaBen? Let's say that and this Rav Asher Weiss discusses explicitly, let's say the mitochondrial donor is not Jewish. is the child halachically Jewish or not? So he says the child is absolutely halachically Jewish. However, he says, the child would need some form of gerus, some form of conversion. Now, if that child now received this form of conversion to instill what he says, Kedushas Yisrael, now grows up and wants to marry a Kohen, can the child marry a Kohen or not? So he says the child can indeed marry a Kohen, because the gerus, the conversion that he required, was really conceptual gerus, but not really halachic gerus. But in terms of marrying the mitochondrial, then it may be an issue, maybe a problem. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah. Right. So Rosh Weiss would say no, because he holds that there's only one halachic mother. So clearly the Goya would be the mother, there would be no halachic problem, the child would not have any shemits of Jewishness, wouldn't be concerned. Others would be. Others would grant more of a maternal role to the mitochondrial donor. Yeah, let me tell you the other aspect of mitochondrial donation, mitochondrial DNA, which is now taking the halachic world by storm. We talked briefly on Shabbos morning about the Kohen gene. The Kohen gene. How many of you are familiar with the Kohen gene? So the Kohen gene is a gene found on the Y chromosome, which is paternally transmitted. And the kahuna status is transmitted from father to son. The mitochondrial DNA is very unique in that it is transmitted exclusively maternally. Now the sperm has mitochondrial DNA, but it's destroyed in the process of conception. Mitochondrial DNA is only transmitted by the mother to a child. What are the halachic ramifications of this? The halachic ramifications of this are profound. Let's say you have the following scenario. A boy comes home from college, and he says, Mom, I got good news and bad news. Good news is I found a girl. Bad news is, unfortunately, she's not Jewish. But she sent a cheek swab to 23andMe, which is a place which does genetic testing, and they found out that her mitochondrial DNA exactly matches the mitochondrial DNA of a Jewish woman from 100 years ago. Let's just say hypothetical, right? So from a genetic perspective, is that child a Jew or not a Jew? Now keep in mind, if this progenitor 100 years ago was halachically Jewish and she has the same mitochondrial DNA, there is no question from a biological perspective that she is the maternal descendant of that individual. And if that woman was Jewish and she's a maternal descendant, mother, daughter, mother, daughter, mother, daughter, she has to be Jewish. So the question is, can she now flip out her cross for a Jewish star and go to shul the next day? Or does she need a conversion? Now that is a pretty interesting scenario, but let me show you how the scenario is playing out in the contemporary halachic world. So that exact scenario we rarely have, because we don't have a data bank of all the mitochondrial DNA of all of our ancestors. But scientists are looking at the mutations in our mitochondrial DNA and have identified certain mitochondrial mutations in the Jewish population, which are unique to the Jewish population. And people in Israel, especially with the Russian population that has now emigrated to Israel, are facing an extremely difficult problem. They are dealing with thousands of people from the former Soviet Union that believe they may be Jewish or want to be Jewish or identify or associate with Judaism, but have absolutely no records whatsoever that associate them with anybody Jewish in their ancestry. All the records in Russia have been destroyed. They don't know where any of their ancestors are buried. There's no gravestones to look at. Is there any possibility that we could use this new genetic test and test their mitochondrial DNA to determine if they have these mutations which are common in the Jewish community? And if they do, maybe the rabbis can use this information to declare them as Jewish based on these mutations. So this question is literally on the desk of the chief rabbinate in Israel today. This is the question that's being addressed. And the question is, does it rise to the level of certainty? How much certainty do you need to determine Jewishness? These are things which they're discussing, and there's literally now books being written on all these kinds of things. I'm actually going to close here, and I'm happy to open for any questions about topics we covered, didn't cover. But in conclusion, we had an opportunity to discuss some aspects of the exciting developments in the last couple years' time and the potential halachic ramifications. We have absolutely no idea what the future holds. There's no way we could have anticipated all the developments that we even discussed today. But there's no question that whatever is ultimately developed, the rabbis of every generation, as they have in all the previous generations, will address these from a comprehensive halachic perspective. So I'm happy to open to all the questions. Yes? Yes. So the halachic ramification, first of all, I refer you to an excellent talk by Rabbi Goldberg, who gave a fantastic talk to your own rabbi, who gave a fantastic talk on transgender and the halachic ramifications of transgender, which you can find online. There's an entire book written, literally, called Dor Tapuchos, Generations of Overturned Generations. On these issues, and our generation is struggling with this. And we're going to ask you to turn to a topic we didn't get a chance to discuss. And I'll mention it to you. It's the topic of different forms of transplants. Now, transgender. Let me just share with you how far we've come. There was a case reported in the New York Times last week of a male to female transgender whose partner had a child, and this was a man converted to a woman, and she, but originally he, wanted to nurse the child. So the team in New York gave hormonal injections, and ultimately, after a few months' time, this male-to-female transgender was able to nurse the child and provide like 16 ounces a day of milk. I'm sorry? Right, the Gemara actually has, you know the Gemara's discussion about a man being able to nurse. That was actually a klala. There is a discussion in the Gemara about a man who lost his wife and then was able to miraculously be able to nurse. That was not necessarily considered something that was positive. Yes?
About the case before, that the girl must be something Jewish about her. So how far can we go?
So is there any similarity between different types of Jews across the world? So the answer is that while we talked specifically about mitochondrial DNA, and we talked about the Y chromosome with respect to the Cohen gene, there are many scientists across the globe that are doing population genetic studies of the entire human genome and identifying commonalities in the human genome of different Jews across the globe. And they have found some commonalities. Obviously, there's more commonalities of people that come from a certain area. And you have to know not only genetics here, you have to know human history and migration patterns and when different populations branched off to different parts of the world. But yes, there are people that are identifying genetic commonalities through specifically in the Jewish population. Now, these genetic commonalities are not going to be sufficient to determine Jewishness. They're interesting discussions, probably not so much halachic ramifications, but really wouldn't be able to determine Jewishness. Yes? Excellent, excellent. You identify that. So if you're doing mitochondrial transfer, that's going to impact the ability to use the mitochondria to determine maternal identity. That's absolutely correct. But the use of mitochondrial transfer is so exceedingly small that it's probably not going to be a consideration. Now and in perpetuity, because it's only used for people who have mitochondrial disease. And there just aren't that many people in the world that have mitochondrial disease. But your point is very, very well taken. I just wanted to comment, by the way, before I take your other questions, about transgender. And I'm saying this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but transgender is a very complicated surgical procedures that are involved. And there are many halachic issues, especially transgendering from male to female. If you remove, we talked about serous, about removing the reproductive organs. Clearly major issues, undergoing major surgeries, clearly major issues. If such a person, if a transgender, male to female, comes into shul as the 10th person, can you count that person for a minyan? On what side of the mechitza do they sit? Do they still have an obligation to put on tefillin and every day? So there are many, many different issues that need resolution. But one of the interesting new transplants that's being considered is head transplants. There's scientists in China that have been working on head transplants, transplanting the heads of mice for already a decade now. And there's an Italian scientist that actually claimed he was able to do a dissection, a head transplant on two cadavers in anticipation of doing ultimately head transplants. And it sounds insane, it sounds like science fiction. And obviously people who have paralysis below the neck would welcome such transplants to be able to restore have bodily function. That would be really an extraordinary thing. But you can imagine a scenario where transgender would want. So, for example, if you want to do a male to female transgender, instead of doing all the surgeries, just transfer the head of a male onto the body of a female. Right? It sounds insane. And if you took the head of a non-Jew and put it on a Jewish body, would that be a goyisha cup? All right. And let's say you took the body of a Kohen and you put the head of the Yisrael. I mean, we could discuss all the different variations and permutations. But this is where we're headed. Yes.
The issue again of the mitochondria.
Yes. Right, the Khmelnytsky Rebellion in the 1600s, right?
And it's possible, even earlier than that, but it's possible that some of those women actually became Jews by Gerut. In other words, they converted to Judaism to marry Jewish men, and that, this very small trace, so they may not, so we don't even know for sure that their mitochondrial DNA.
But the truth is, at this point, post facto, it doesn't matter. Because even if they were Gerim, if they're halachically Jewish and their mitochondrial DNA is found in mitochondria, you understand what I'm saying? It may not have halachic ramifications if they were halachically Jewish and they were Gerim. Their mitochondrial DNA would still be relevant. Going to share.
No, I'm saying that in terms of analyzing mitochondrial DNA, the mitochondria are probably going to be present in all
Right, no, you're right, you're absolutely right. So conversion would affect the mitochondrial DNA just like the mitochondrial transfer would. I'll get to your question in a second, but I want to share with you the most fascinating application of mitochondrial DNA, unimaginable application of the perpetuity of the mitochondrial DNA. How many of you have read the Shakespearean play Richard III? Anybody? So Richard III was not a very popular king. And as a matter of fact, it was never known where he was buried. Yeah. You go to Westminster Abbey, you will not find Richard III. And as he's portrayed in the Shakespearean play, he's hunchback, right? And there actually is a society today that maintains that Richard III wasn't hunchback. And they're they advocate for the fact that Richard III really wasn't a hunchback, and it's he's gotten a bad rap all these centuries. Someone did some amazing archaeological research to try and find out where Richard III was buried, and they found a parking lot in Leicester, England, that underneath which was a church from the 1500s. In that church was a burial ground, in that burial ground, they found a place where the church usually apportions to famous or prominent people to bury. In that section, they found a skeleton. And by the way, this church was very close to the battlefield where Richard III died. In that church, they found a skeleton, which has severe kyphoscoliosis, which means hunchback, and had significant trauma to the skull, which is how Richard III died on the battlefield. And they believed that this was really the skeleton of Richard III. But how are you going to prove it 100% beyond a shadow of a doubt? The only way is genetics. How are you going to genetically identify a skeleton from the 1500s to see if it's Richard III? So in an astounding genealogical research, they identified two living relatives who were maternal relatives from Richard III's mother. Do you understand what that means? It means they have to be Bas Achar Bas from the 1500s. 1400s, late 1400s. Late 1400s. So they identified two living relatives, and they tested their mitochondrial DNA, and they found a 99.9% match between the mitochondrial DNA of these relatives and the bones of the skeleton, which basically verified that absolutely, beyond shadow of doubt, this was indeed Richard III. And they exhumed his skeleton, and they actually reburied him with great fanfare in England. But thank you so much for a wonderful discussion today, and happy to continue the discussion for those who want.
Can I ask a question of yesterday?
Sure, sure.
So how do you deal with somebody talking to you, or how you feel about it?
When are you heading back north? I'm sorry.
I'm headed back this afternoon.
Safe trip.
Thanks. This is the community you live in? This is where you live?
Only during the winter.
Great. Very nice.
See you in about a month.
Yeah, looking forward.
The Jews are not allowed to donate, and yet they are.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So to answer that question.
So first of all, according to some...
Okay.